Hello, I'm Ross Camage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs, of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science. And my guest today is Christy Carl, and amongst other things, Christy's going to help us explore the world of cancer communication through a journalist's eyes. So, Christy, I know I've just kind of stolen a tiny bit of your thunder, but would you care to introduce yourself in any way that you see fit?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me. My name is Christy Call. I am the Vice President of Content for our oncology pillar that's here at MGH Life Sciences. My focus is obviously in oncology, so I oversee a variety of brands, including OncLive, as well as Targeted Oncology, Cancer Network, Oncology Nursing News, Urology Times, and then Cure. So, you know, our aim is really just to connect the health world from care provider to patient to any involvement really in the medical landscape.
Let's start by explaining to those who don't know what Michael J. Hennessy is. And I don't know whether that's what he is or what MGH is, because there's both a person and a product.
Sure. Yeah. MGH Life Sciences was founded by Michael Hennessy Sr. And now his son, Michael Hennessy Jr., oversees the company. He's our CEO and president. You know, we're really just an overwhelming kind of healthcare communications company. So we have a lot of different umbrellas, if you will. And so we work specifically with the content side, with publications and websites to help educate healthcare professionals and providing, you know, superior care to patients across a broad spectrum. So we're focused in oncology, but we also have healthcare specialty groups. We even have a veterinary group. So we kind of run the gambit of healthcare really at MGH. And that's our main goal, honestly, is just to provide that knowledge and the insight so that way we can just improve healthcare as a whole.
So you're in charge of all of the oncology content? You're the tippity top of the oncology tree?
Yes. Yes, tippity top.
And then how long have you been at MGH?
Yeah, so I'm going on 7 years at MGH. I started in 2017 just with two brands. So I started off with Cure and Oncology Nursing News, and over the years just kept taking on more.
Let's dig in a little bit to you. So how did you get into this journalism? Is journalism the right title for all of this, if you want an encapsulating term?
Yeah, I would say journalism is definitely a fit. And so I studied journalism. I've always been a writer, admittedly. Even when I was 9, I wrote like short stories and things like that. So when I went to college, I studied journalism. Actually, my interests admittedly lied in sports, not healthcare. I actually didn't even know healthcare publication was like a thing back in the early 2000s. So I started off in sports, ended up going to graduate school for sports management. Worked for the Philadelphia Flyers for a little bit, moved to upstate New York to work for a small Division I school. So I was in sports for a bit and realized long-term was just not a fit for me, really. And I fell into healthcare, to be honest. I had a friend who worked back down here in South Jersey, and I wanted to move back home when I was in New York. So I was kind of up for any job at the time, admittedly. And she kind of said, you know, my company's always hiring. Do you want to just throw your resume in? So I did. And I, you know, I had to start from the bottom again and pretty much be like an editorial assistant. And I started in eye care. And at the time I was like, I don't know if this is a fit for me either, but it's a job and I'm back home. And then I started with the hematology and oncology brand at that company. And that's where it kind of really stuck for me. And that's when I knew this is where I'm supposed to be.
You studied journalism.
Yes.
So is it, they teach you how to write, they teach you how to sell? I mean, what, you know, you come out of that and then you're expecting to get a job in journalism. I think you told me like you graduated at exactly the wrong time to try and get a job.
Yes. So in undergrad for journalism, they, you know, you have to have a knack for writing, I'd say, but they teach you how to conduct an interview, how to do investigative journalism, how to do feature writing, how to do radio, how to do TV. So it wasn't just kind of like print journalism, like newspapers. So it's kind of the broad spectrum of communications. I did graduate shortly after the bubble burst in 08. So a lot of my professors were kind of dreary, telling us, you know, print's dead. So I graduated at a time where I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life.
Well, so it's funny because yes, there's there. I remember that bit where like every newspaper was sort of closing up its print shop. I mean, I guess it gets rid of the kind of, you know, the hackneyed journalist, you know, just breaking the news on some story. But there's still journalism out there. It's just in a different format.
Yeah, especially when I was in school, that's when social media really started to take off. So Twitter came out. And so that was, I even had a class where it was just focused on making a name for yourself and a brand for yourself on Twitter thoughts and how to start a blog and things like that. So we started to explore different areas since the idea of print was quote unquote dying at the time. So it did help me kind of expand to realize there's more beyond just the print newspaper. I think that helped out a lot. And obviously, you know, with the multimedia universe that we live in today, I think it's a good skill to have as a journalist to be able to kind of go beyond just writing form. So my undergrad was kind of a multitude of learning how to write, how to do other areas so that I could better market myself as a journalist after I got out of school.
I saw you kind of had a minor in sports education. I can't remember what it was. What was your minor in?
So it was in business of sport.
Okay. And was that because you always imagined yourself as this kind of journalist sort of following some sports team? Or what were you imagining when you were an undergraduate?
Yeah. So I started off, I interned my freshman year at a local newspaper and I did some freelance for another local newspaper down here in South Jersey where I'd cover like football games and local high school sports. And I enjoyed that, but I realized I wanted something a little bit more than just kind of being like a beat writer. So in my junior year, I actually was able to go behind the scenes at a Philadelphia Sixers game and I got to see what their media relations department
did. Can you
did.
Explain to those who are ignorant what sport that is? And I apologize to all Philadelphia Sixer fans. I don't know.
More than okay. Yeah. So that's our basketball team here in Philadelphia. Okay. Yeah. So I got to go behind the scenes and cover that game and mirror the media relations expert for that team. And that's when I realized this is what I think I want to do within the sports realm is be the liaison between the media and the sports team. So still having that journalistic integrity and that ability to, you know, write, but be more of that liaison and work in sports and be get paid to watch sports.
Is that like issuing press releases for the sports team, for want of a better term?
Yeah, essentially. So even when I worked for the Philadelphia Flyers, that was pretty much my day-to-day was being, you know, reporting stats, compiling stats for the media to utilize throughout the game, during actual game time, going through and updating the live stats for the media that we're attending and watching, and then organizing interviews between the media and athletes and things like that. So you were kind of that go-between and planning to hopefully push out a good story as long as they won.
Yeah. The Flyers is a hockey team. Just
yes,
to clarify.
Hockey, yeah.
Yeah, that I did my homework on that one. So yeah. And then you told me this thing, it's kind of like you've got your kind of quote unquote dream job. You're in sports, you're in journalism. When was the epiphany that, you know, this wasn't all it cracked up to be, at least for you?
Yeah. So when I was in upstate New York, it was a very different world up there, admittedly. I loved working for the college. It was a great experience to be able to work across different sports that I had never really followed. Like I'm a big lacrosse fan because I worked at the college and covered that sport. But long term, I started to realize I hit my mid-20s and realized that I wanted a career where I could actually move up and have promotions and work towards something. And in sports, your promotions are really kind of more aligned with moving to a different school or a bigger D1 college. And I realized I just wanted more stability, essentially. I wanted to be able to have a career trajectory without uprooting my life every few years to get that next step or that next promotion. So I realized for me personally, I wanted to have, you know, feet on the ground somewhere and have a little bit more of an aspiration. I didn't think sports was a fit anymore.
And then I think you told me this, and it wouldn't be a surprise, is how male dominated is sports journalism?
Yes, very, very male dominated. It's hard for women to break through. I know, like when I worked for the Philadelphia Flyers, for example, of all of the heads of the PR departments across the NHL at that time in 2012, there was only one female. The rest were all male. And so it's very hard. I think it's gotten better, admittedly. I think probably since I was involved in sports, but at the time it was very hard to break through and to make your case, you know, I would get asked interview questions on how I would handle a locker room and things like that. And it was a struggle to kind of break in as a female in sport.
Yeah. What was your answer?
That I would be professional and, you know, like any other male
would. Keep the camera at eye level, you know.
Right. Yeah. So it's definitely a struggle for women in sport. And I think we've come a long way, but there's probably a lot more room to grow in that area for women in sport.
Well, I also wonder whether the growth of of women's sports might help that in a kind of in a parallel sort of way.
Yeah, I think the U.S. women's soccer team has definitely taken that narrative a lot farther over the years. So it's still an uphill battle, but we've made steps in that area. But at the time, it was definitely one of my challenges trying to break in into the industry.
Okay, so you switch with a company called Slack to healthcare journalism. And this is the thing that I find amazing is, you know, you have your skill as a writer, and then the subject matter seems like that's an afterthought. It's like, you know, I can write about anything. I have a friend who's a writer who, you know, normally writes about healthcare, but last week had to write an article on horseshoes. You know, that's just, it's wherever the, you know, the dollar's coming from. How much of a learning curve was it to suddenly switch to, what did you say, eye care, and then something else, and then you end up in hematology and oncology? I mean, it's like, when do you become an expert?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think I always tell people, especially with cancer, it takes probably at least a year to learn how to write cancer. And even then, because there's so many novel therapies and new things happening, you're always learning. So I think, you know, as long as you have that kind of basic journalistic ability to kind of do that inverted pyramid with, you know, a lead, a quote, going into the meat of your story, and then, you know, kind of filling in the blanks as you get further down that the bottom of the triangle, I think is kind of that algorithm that most journalists follow. So to be able to kind of take that subject matter and turn it into an article can be pretty step and repeat. I think the difference with healthcare is really learning the data, right? Because we're not healthcare professionals. So we're just regurgitating sometimes information that we might not understand, that the physicians obviously understand a lot better than we do, which is why we lean into our key opinion leaders to help, you know, explain some of the things to us. But it takes time, but it takes that passion for learning that really makes somebody strive in the healthcare media. Whereas, you know, writing sports, I think, if you're passionate about sports, you're going to love writing sports, right? I think sometimes it lies within people's passions, and healthcare is not always somebody's passion, right? So I think it takes that passion for learning that really makes somebody who wants to write healthcare, that drives their success.
And you told me there was a, maybe it was coincidence, but there was a personal overlap whereby hematology oncology started to have a different meaning for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when I was growing up, my best friend from childhood, she was diagnosed with Ewing sarcoma when we were 15. High school looked a little different for our friend group, unfortunately, but I had a close tie to cancer specifically. So I think when I got into hematology and oncology and I was seeing the progress we were making in the cancer space, it really kind of lurched me forward into knowing this is what I was meant to do. Just seeing what she went through, what her family went through, what we as her friends went through, and watching her go through treatment and shaving her head and watching the financial toxicity that her family, you know, went through. And even after her passing, you know, it's still something that sticks with me. That's the day that I realized, I think this is what I'm meant to be doing.
And when you moved to MGH, I think you said about 7 years ago, one of the things when you listed those, you know, six different pillars, I think it was, that, you know, ranging from Cure magazine, which is directed to patients, to Urology Times, which is presumably directed to healthcare professionals, and sort of various stuff in between. One of the things that struck me is you might have the same story, but very different audiences for these different platforms. And so we talked about writing, but how do you change the story for the audience? In particular, I think the hardest thing is writing a meaningful story for a non-expert audience.
Yeah. And I think that's why we try to tap into and why we have so many different publications that are meant for the different audiences within oncology, because I think you can learn from all levels of expertise and experience. And, you know, especially in the cancer space, because it's so evolving and you have so many different specialties, I think from either a professional standpoint, whether you're a healthcare provider or if you're a patient, I think you can learn from the different voices within the field. And for patients, I think it's even more interesting because they go into this as one of the scariest days of their lives. Like the second you hear you have cancer, it's your mind is blown.
Yeah.
And so after that, you know, it's not over, right? You have to go through treatment. You have to go through its side effects. You have to go through the financial toxicity. You have to go, there's so much into treating the patient as a whole. And so if we can try to educate them with key opinion leaders who can educate from a treatment standpoint, and then if we can take a nurse who can educate our patients on the side effects to be aware of and how to treat those, and then we even work with advocacy groups to really educate the patients on, you know, the areas outside of treatment. And so there's not a lack of wanting to learn on their side. I think they're actually more educated than we give them credit for. Knowledge is power for them. And the more we can educate them and put information in their hands so that they can at least advocate for themselves, I think is key. So it's interesting how wildly different the areas can be, but it all applies to them and they want to know.
It's funny. So sometimes I've done news stories, and after a while, it became clear that, you know, they had this, you know, 1.5-minute slot on the TV, and they would essentially have the same canned story. They just change out the details. You know, Mrs. Jones was doing badly, and then she went to an experimental treatment and is now doing great. This mm-hmm. is amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't mention the disease. We don't mention the pill. Cut mm-hmm. back to the studio, and somebody goes, well, do you think this is a cure? And they go, well, maybe not yet, but maybe. And it's like, this is so boring. So how do you stop your stories? I think you told me, you know, you search the kind of ASCO abstracts and everything else and try and pull a story out of it, turning into just this, you know, here's the canned, you know, is it a cure story for the patients? Or equally in that, this is a complex question, you know, how do you stop false hope?
Right. Yeah, I think there's a lot of transparency, and sometimes you have to be careful, right? We talk a lot at CURE about making sure that we're not being clickbaity. We yeah. want to make sure that we are an informed source for our patients and that they can rely on us. So I think that's where we do delve into our relationships with the physicians and the multidisciplinary approach, so that we make it clear we're not the experts. We're, you know, just kind of reiterating the data to help you understand what it means. And then we're also speaking with the doctors so they can also put it in lay terms for the patients to understand what's going on in the landscape, whether it be, you know, about this treatment coming out of ASCO or a new FDA approval. And, you know, I think really tapping into that combination for our audience is key, of giving them access to these key opinion leaders that they might not have access to. You know, if you're in the Midwest, you might not have access to a top-notch doc from New York City. So we try to bridge that gap through interviews, through videos with them, through covering their content out of these big meetings and things like that. And then in addition, we do try to get the patient voice in there too, right? Because I think patients learn from other patients and they don't want to feel alone. So I think a combination of educating them and then also connecting them goes a long way for what's a very scary time.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. One thing, I was at something called the Lung Cancer Roundtable, which was, you know, very patient focused and trying to sort of address issues associated with survivorship in the broader sense. And one of the things was explaining toxicity to patients, because, you know, people don't think in terms of, you know, grade 1, 2, and 3. It doesn't mean
right.
anything.
Right.
And yet we get this kind of, you know, editorialization, which is, you know, the treatment was well tolerated, or even worse, the treatment had acceptable toxicity.
Right.
Acceptable to who? My doctor thinks my side effects are acceptable, you know. And so finding some way of communicating that in real world terms to a patient is like, I don't care if I have grade 2, whatever. I want to know if I can leave the house without, you know, having to run to the bathroom every 10 seconds.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And that's where I think transparently, not all physicians are great at speaking with patients, right?
Yeah. Some people are super smart, but communication skills were low down on their list of skills.
Exactly. So we tap into a list of doctors that we know have kind of that good bedside manner, if you will, where they can explain it. Because I think a lot of the doctors we talk to, one of the questions we try to get them to convey to the patients is that quality of life is key. So you might have these side effects, but we also want the patients to advocate for themselves or speak up about what's important to them. So, you know, if you're being treated with a super toxic regimen, but you have your daughter's wedding coming up, we want the patients to be able to have that discussion with their doctors to say, this is important to me, so that maybe we can titrate down that regimen or hold for a little bit to make sure that you're able to attend that wedding and things like that. And I think patient-physician communication is so key. And we try to make sure that when we're reporting on data or treatment or side effects or areas outside of treatment, that we're just constantly reminding the patients that they have a voice in this journey that they have, and that what matters to them means a lot, and they have to be able to communicate that and advocate for themselves. And if they can't advocate for themselves, making sure they have a caregiver that can do that on their behalf. But it's very important at the end of the day that we are treating this disease, but at the same time, you're living a quality life.
It sounds like of the headlines, and you know, I know you have to be a good parent to all of these things, but is Cure still your baby?
It is. I'm sorry. I love all of my oncology children, if you will, but Cure is the brand I started with. So I think it's a brand that I know like the back of my hand at this point. I think it's a passion project for me too, just given my connection to cancer. And it is one of those brands where you get to meet these patients, you get to meet their caregivers. And it's almost a daily reminder of why I do what I do in working with these patients and hearing their stories and sharing their stories and why it's important.
We talked about, you know, print dying off, but is Cure still, does it have a print existence? I mean, my recollection is it used to be a free magazine that would be sitting in waiting rooms and things like that. But, you know, what does Cure look like now?
Sure. Yeah. So we still come out quarterly with a broader issue for all of our patients. And then we'll have quarterly cancer specific issues as well. So it can span to breast cancer specific or lung cancer specific or genitourinary specific. And then we also have a magazine called Heal that comes out twice a year that's specific for survivors. So we try to really address like the long-term effects from, you know, cancer and its treatment.
So survivors is this kind of hot button topic. So are you survivors like you're done with your treatment and then off you go, or survivors you're a survivor from day one from diagnosis?
So I think that narrative's actually changed even since I started here, you know, almost 7 years ago. I think 7 years ago, survivor was, okay, you're done treatment, you have no evidence of disease, you're ready to move past and transition back to like your primary care provider. Now, I think that's changed where a lot of patients have told us, I'm a survivor the day I got diagnosed. So I think it's been a mix and a culmination of trying to help patients from the day they've been diagnosed, because we know those side effects last a lifetime. And I think we're also addressing it in a way because cancer has changed where there are some cancer types that it's considered more of like a chronic disease now.
Yeah.
So we're trying to address it there too, where you might be on some kind of maintenance therapy long term. So how do you deal with that? I don't think there's one clear cut definition of a survivor anymore.
No, and I do think that the appetite for some cancers is changing. So there's still some cancers which have such an appalling prognosis that right. It still feels like the cancer treatment from 20, 30 years ago, where it's like, right. I just want to be alive. I just want to be above ground, right. And I'll take whatever you can give me. Whereas yeah. I think for others, appropriately, the appetite for normality increases yeah. because it's like, okay, you're controlling the cancer. And maybe I don't want these side effects. Maybe I want to discuss dose reduction or treatment modification or something because I want to go back to some aspect of normality for me.
Right.
That's progress. I mean, it's kind of like, are you satisfied? I mean, you're still alive. It's like, no, I'm not satisfied. I want to be alive and I want this to be a footnote in my life, not a headline.
Right. Yeah. The new normal. That's essentially, yeah. That's kind of what we call it is, you know, the day you're diagnosed with cancer, it's this new normal. And even when maybe you don't have evidence of disease or it is considered chronic and you're able to just be on long-term therapy, this new normal of what side effects am I going to feel? Or, you know, those days where there might be chemo brain and yeah. why is this happening? So it is always going to be this new normal. And I think that's why patients are saying the day I'm diagnosed, I'm a survivor, because this is a journey and not just a year-long thing.
We're starting something here, and maybe it's a little too cute, I don't know, but you know, I'm one of the architects of it, so I'm not going to think it's too cute, maybe just a little cute, which is we want to try and ask every member of staff who works in the cancer center in an anonymous way, whether they have a personal history of cancer or a close family or friend connection, and then, you know, put that out front that says, you know, of X staff here, X percentage have this connection to cancer, to try and normalize it. And, mm-hmm. you know, I would love to get to the point where I could actually say, you know, of the 10 people treating you today, you know, three of them have or have had cancer, mm-hmm. to just go, oh, you know, oh, wow. I mean, for example, we have One of our medical assistants is actually on oxygen for other reasons, not cancer-related reasons. But it's an incredible, powerful thing with somebody coming in short of breath, and then the person who clearly is holding down a full-time job takes you to your room wearing oxygen. And so, again, that normalization for me is terribly important. So this is leading to a question. So how many staff members at MJH do you think have got a personal history of cancer or close connection? Because that would be good to know.
Yeah. I think I can't put an exact number on it, but I always tell people to this day, I don't know that there's really many people out there anymore that don't know somebody who's had cancer or has been affected by cancer. And even Mike Hennessy, our CEO, you know, his mom had cancer. And I think that sparked a lot of the passion behind Cure and Heal for both Mike Sr. and Mike Jr. and what we're doing in the oncology space. So crazy enough, I know, you know, we don't ask that on a questionnaire, but I'm sure if we did a survey of the 30 some odd associates, probably more than half would say that they at least have some kind of a connection, even if it's, you know, a distant relative or a close family friend. I think it's just that common now, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, we had a time when, you know, we had a research assistant who was a childhood cancer survivor. We had a nurse who was a childhood cancer survivor. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's like, you know, once you scratch the surface and it sort of comes out in a conversation over coffee, you know, the everyone else has a story, and it's pretty amazing. And I think that increases the sense of togetherness between the patient and the staff. So I think it's kind of important.
Yeah, and I think it helps you to understand who you're writing for. It puts a face to the purpose for us here.
Yeah. Amongst all of these stories, you know, we talked about how this stuff is evolving. We've got to talk about artificial intelligence and, you know, chat GPT or whatever these things are. I mean, can you just push a button and it just writes a story and you just go, oh, this is the best intern I've ever had, you know?
So funny enough, when AI started to really kind of boom, probably about a year or so ago, that was the fear, right? It was, is AI going to replace us? And we realized pretty quickly on that it can't necessarily replace us, but it can help us. So, right. So just like we're doing here, AI would not be able to do a face-to-face interview or getting direct quotes or really learning from your peers. So it can't replace us in that facet. But what we can do is have it assist in our video production and to streamline processes and to help us transcribe interviews and things like that. So we're trying to utilize it in a way where it's not replacing us, but it's helping us do our jobs even better than before.
From your, you know, whatever, 10, 15 years of experience in this thing and 7 years at MJH, first of all, like, what makes a good story? What makes a bad story? But also, as you have evolved, you're in this incredibly powerful position. You're like the Rupert Murdoch of oncology, you know. What have you learned?
I've learned how to lead by example. I think when I started off in, even in sports and as I've moved on into healthcare and beyond, the one thing that I've always been known as kind of an overachiever, admittedly, and that was my nickname in college from my
overachiever and proud of it, you know,
overachiever and proud of it. Yeah. So I, you know, nothing is ever off limits for me. And even if I hit the next milestone, then it's on to the next. What can I challenge myself with after this? And what next steps can I take? And even as I've, you know, ventured into being a vice president, I've tried to even expand on what else can I teach myself? What else can I learn? And then in turn, what else can I learn and teach my peers and my associates and those around me so that we can just improve as a whole and incorporate new strategies and new innovations across the board to just enhance what I think is already great content and to really just put even better knowledge and education into the hands of our providers and our patients.
Do you have examples of kind of like, wow, that was like one of my best stories, you know, or ones where you go, oh, I totally messed that one up?
Article wise, let's see. Well, you know, it's never fun when you have to cover data and you get like one like digit wrong and it just skews the data. So that, how, you know, when you're writing stories from like ASCO, for example, typos happen. But usually when you get like a press person who emails you and they're like, hey, you misspelled the atezolizumab. Can you, you know, that's never fun, but that happens. It does. And then I think, you know, I don't, my best story, I don't know if I can tap into just one, but I think where I knew I was starting to really hit my stride in my growth, we started the podcast on Cure many moons ago. And my first podcast interview that I did was with a patient who he had prostate cancer. And they were doing a runway fundraiser for prostate cancer. And he was just the most entertaining and the biggest personality. And the podcast did great. And I felt like once that launched and people listened, my friends listened, my family listened, and they were like, this is amazing. I realized like, okay, so we can have fun with this too. We can be innovative and actually do some fun things to share people's stories in different ways.
When you're a writer, nobody sees you. You're just a byline.
Yeah.
But you've also, in your position, you've had to move into this kind of more public facing, you know, standing up. And how have you done that?
Yeah.
Did that come naturally?
Yeah, surprisingly. I had a college course that was public speaking and I hated it. And I was like, I'm never going to use this. And now I use it all the time. So yeah, when I started off, you know, it was always behind the scenes and that kind of thing. And then as I grew at MJH, I realized I wanted to be known. I wanted key opinion leaders to know who I was and to be able to, you know, hopefully create that kind of a relationship where they knew me, I know them. And if we do need to do an interview, it's not, who is this girl, Christy Kyle, but, oh, Christy, I'd be happy to do it. So
yeah.
As I grew, I realized I wanted to kind of also grow that, my connections. And then as time went on, Cure does these award ceremonies, one being Extraordinary Healer, which back before COVID used to have 1,000 nurses. Now we have 500 nurses. And I remember my manager came to me and said, we want you to be the MC of these award ceremonies. And I remember thinking like, I can't do that in front of that many people. It's not possible. And I told my dad, and my dad looked at me and he said, well, if you would have asked 5 years ago, would you have seen yourself overseeing two publications and you're doing great there? So why can't you do this?
Yeah.
And honestly, ever since then, I've just kind of gone into it as, you know, this is another thing that adds to the why I love my job and what I do. So yeah. So now I'm a, you know, add MC to the my cover story, you know, my CV.
That's pretty cool. You've done such amazing work. We didn't touch on Christy Kyle as a person. So you moved back to, you're in New Jersey, I think just across the road from Philly.
Yep.
What's happening in your life at present?
I have a dog who is thankfully being quiet on this interview right now. And I've been a homeowner for 4 years now. So that is a pride and joy of mine of taking care of this house and remodeling it and all of that fun stuff. And honestly, outside of that, it's, you know, I'm an athlete. I still play soccer. I just finished my first 10-mile run, which is exciting. And now I'm doing a half marathon this year, which might make me crazy. So personally, yeah, I think it's just from a work-life balance is just my passion projects on the side is what keeps me going sometimes.
It's funny because you know, that point when you were the trailing journalist for the Philadelphia Flyers, and now you've actually got a place with roots and everything else. It's like, you have to be careful what you dream of because you seem to be achieving it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I always said I wanted to buy a house so that my dog could have a backyard, and now she has a beautiful backyard. So we've checked that off the list.
That's fantastic. So in the future, let's just say in the next 5 years, you know, what do we want Christy Kyle to be doing personally and professionally, apart from everybody to know your name? It's like, you know, fame, remember my name, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously health and prosperity for the personal life and to just continue, you know, hitting different milestones, like in my runs and things like that. And then professionally, I mean, I think, you know, the reason I stuck with cancer and the reason that I think it's been such a passion of mine is how far we've come. And I think just seeing from when my friend was diagnosed and how far we've come with treatment there. And then even when, you know, I remember when the first CAR T-cell treatment got approved. And I remember thinking to myself, like, this is big. I want to be a part of every big milestone that cancer has to offer. And I want to be on the front lines reporting it. So I think for me, long-term is just to continue to be a part of the big things, the discoveries and, you know, these innovative treatments. And, you know, the more we can see these different cancer types hopefully turn into more of a chronic disease and not a death sentence anymore. And I want to be a part of it all. And hopefully just continue to help people and help them know that they're not alone in this journey and that there's hope. moving forward.
That's amazing. I wish you the best of luck. I think you've done great.
Thanks,
Christy.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with me, Ross Camage. Rate us and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or follow us at DR Camage on X for additional commentary.